You're listening to a podcast from 702.
You're with Clement Maniatella.
702. Let's walk the talk.
I want us to look at the Constitutional Court judgment now that was delivered on Friday on the Riot Act and its implications for freedom of speech. The Apex Court declared Section 18.2B of the Rioters Assemblies Act invalid because, and I quote, the disproportionality of its societal benefit to its vast invasion of free expression and consequential inconsistency with the Constitution, end quote. And remember, the constitutional challenge was brought by EFF leader Julius Malema and his party after he was charged under the Act for the public comments that he had allegedly made inciting people to occupy land. Do you remember that comment he made?
When we live here, you see any beautiful piece of land, you like it, occupy it, it belongs to you, it is your land, it is the land of our forefathers, it is a land that was taken from us by white people by force through genocide. They killed our people. We are not talking violence, we are not promoting violence, but I cannot guarantee the future. I'm not a prophet, I'm talking now. We are not carrying any weapons. I will never kill white people. Why should I kill them? I will never revenge for what they did. I'm asking politely for the land to be returned. And if they don't return it, I cannot guarantee what will happen next. But they must be assured that this land we are fighting for peacefully, we are fighting for in parliament, we are fighting for this land on the streets, because we must conscientize society.
You know this trick that, you know, the EFF leaders always have, where they will say something and try sanitize it on the side and say, well, we're not advocating for violence. And then when you listen to what they said in the beginning, you know, I remember even when they were talking about people like Ranjeni Monsami outside the State Capture Commission, they were like, attack. And then they're like, no, but we don't attack people. And then you're like, but what you're saying now, it's a little different from what you said in the beginning. But anyway, the thrust of the charges against Malema was that he incited EFF members and other people to commit an offense by occupying land without lawful permission. And that offense that people were allegedly incited to commit was said to be trespassing in terms of Section 1 of the Trespassing Act. So the case was put on hold while Malema was challenging the constitutionality of what he called the apartheid law, this Rioters Assemblies Act. And it is, because the act was actually a piece of security legislation passed in 1956 to suppress political opposition towards the apartheid government. So the act wanted to create a crime of incitement. So a person is guilty of incitement if they encourage or instigate another person to commit a crime. And if found guilty, they can be sentenced to the same punishment as the person who actually committed the crime. The NPA has to now decide whether they're going to go ahead with the charges or not. But I want us to have a conversation about what the judgment declaring this act invalid, what that means for freedom of expression and inciting violence. Is it a rousing defense of freedom of expression? What does it mean for crimes of incitement? Do you think someone who incites a crime must be sentenced to the same punishment as someone convicted, if actually, you know, the person committed that crime? Join this conversation and tell me what your thoughts are around that judgment. 011-883-0702. You can WhatsApp me on 072-702-1702. Your SMS is on 31702. Dr. James Grant is an advocate of the High Court and is going to help us understand this judgment much better. Dr. Grant, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Clement. So good to talk to you. Good morning to the listeners.
So this Rioters Assembly Act, it states that it's a crime to incite someone to commit any crime. What were the implications of this act on freedom of speech? Because the Chief Justice, Mokgweng Mokgweng, wrote in the majority judgment that the fundamental right to free expression is severely curtailed.
Well, the curtailment of freedom of speech was in place in 1956 by virtue of all sorts of other legislation. What's truly troubling about this judgment is that it takes aim at a piece of legislation which was enacted not only by a bunch of evil folk, but a bunch of idiots. Because what they didn't realize in creating this crime is that they were simply duplicating a crime which already existed and was confirmed in our law in 1921. The crime of incitement is a common law crime that exists and continues to exist, and it continues to exist notwithstanding the Constitutional Court judgment of Friday, I'm sorry to say.
It's, explain to us in what context it continues to exist. What does the law say when it comes to the crime of incitement? And what has it always been saying?
It's always said that if one encourages another, procures another to commit any offense, you commit the offense of incitement. And that was in 1921.
Yeah.
Now, the idiots responsible for apartheid created a horrendous piece of legislation in the Riotous Assemblies Act. We're all on the same page with that. But they simply repeated or duplicated the existing offense. And what they were trying to do is trying to, in fact, make the penalty a lot worse than it was. The whole framing of that crime is to make it the case that if you commit the offense, then you get to go to prison for as long as the person who actually commits the offense.
Yeah.
That was the focus of it, whereas the existing crime had no such provision.
So what the Apex Court has essentially done then is limit the crime of incitement to those comments that incite people to commit a serious offense. But it doesn't look like the court almost developed a clearer standard of how to assess this seriousness, because all the judgment did was list murder, rape, armed robbery, fraud, human trafficking and corruption as some of the offenses that self-evidently fall within the realm. In the meaning of serious offences, it was not really clear whether trespassing would be deemed to fall within that realm of serious crime.
Correct. That's another difficulty with the decision, is it introduces this concept of seriousness. And it also goes on about how, for instance, you wouldn't want to just leave things as they are for a court to decide whether another defense is available for a person, because there would be a lack of clarity. A person would never know whether what they're saying is covered by the crime of incitement or not. Now it's introduced a new consideration. When a person is exercising their freedom of speech, they need to consider whether they are inciting another person to commit a serious offense, whereas nobody knows what that can possibly mean.
So what are the implications then, Dr. Grant, on the charges Julius Malema is facing? The EFF believes that the charges against him no longer stand. Can Malema use this judgment to make representation to the NPA head, Shamila Batoi, for the charges to be dropped?
He certainly can, but he's facing at least the following difficulty, that while they might have charged him under the statutory provision, they can simply now reframe the charges and pursue him under the common law crime, which was always in existence. The distinction, if I may, for your listeners, is that the crime which has been struck down, or at least limited now by the Constitutional Court, is a statutory crime. That's a crime made by Parliament. The common law crime is crimes created by our courts, and that's what I'm talking about existed or was recognized in 1921, and that continues to exist.
What's best, though, for the NPA to do here? Because I'm just thinking, if they drop the charges, that may send a message to Julius Malema and the EFF and even other people and other groups that inciting people to illegally occupy land will not have any criminal justice consequences, while those that they incite continue to face arrest and prosecution for, in this case, trespassing. I'm wondering what is best for the NPA, and I hear you say they can maybe even just go for the common law crime and continue to pursue that case. Would it be the best thing to do, considering what message, whatever decision they take, may send out?
I think that they need to test this legislation now, what's left of it, given what the Constitutional Court has said. And I think, therefore, they have to proceed with the charges against Mr. Malema. I think also that there's every possibility of them succeeding on a charge of common law incitement. And I think that it's in line with the question that you asked, is, you know, to what extent have we now got a very clear understanding or declaration of the right to freedom of speech? Unfortunately, we don't have a clear declaration of the exercise of a freedom of speech relative to an offense. So, for instance, the Constitutional Court, even in this case, didn't consider whether one may express oneself relative to, for instance, other rights that might be infringed by the crime. So, for instance, it didn't consider the crime of trespass and that it might infringe one's right to property or right to privacy, right to dignity. Other offences, it didn't consider if it was incitement, for instance, to steal. That would be an infringement of one's right to property. So we don't have a statement or clarification of one's right to freedom of speech relative to other rights. And it's, for me, a sad fact that it didn't realize that that's what the law requires as it stands. It didn't need to actually say anything.
Dr. Grant, thank you so much for being available to exceptionally explain these legal matters to us. I really appreciate your time.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Dr. James Grant is an advocate of the High Court in explaining just what the implications of that judgment by the Constitutional Court on Friday are on freedom of speech, but also on the case against EFF leader Julius Malema.
702.
The Clement Maniatela Show.
Let's walk the talk.
It's going up to 25 minutes before 11 o'clock. I'm in conversation with Stephen McGowan, and he has just detailed the story of him being held captive and being kidnapped by Al-Qaeda. 6 Years with Al-Qaeda is the name of the book, the Stephen McGowan story. I'm sure you've heard about the story on the radio over the last couple of years, when he was kidnapped and when he was released. And we're talking about when it happened. And Stephen, I wanted you to pick up from, you know, when you were driving from Timbuktu and they were driving you guys to the desert. It was quite a very long journey. And I want to read from the book, because there's something interesting that you say around the British passport. And I want you to explain to us why that moment, you feared that moment so much. You say in the book that the only other thing that I had was my wedding ring. That was it. So I thought, around 8 p.m., while squirming to find a comfortable position, I felt a small rectangular shape in the pocket of my shorts. It was my British passport. It took split second for me to understand my situation. I felt the blood drain from my face and the vast vestiges of hope began to spin away. And then later on, you explain that when they found that British passport, all hell broke loose. Everyone started shouting, Allahu Akbar. And they started dropping to their ground on their knees, one on my left, another on my right, and more a few meters in front of me. They were hitting the sand in prayer and to give thanks to Allah for a gift he had bestowed on them. Why was it so significant, that moment when they found your British passport, and why did you fear that moment so much?
Gee whiz, Clement, this moment was the start of something which would haunt me for literally my 5 years, 8 months. I mean, this was a realization that things had become so much worse. You know, obviously, as South Africans, we don't really deal with Al-Qaeda or know about, you know, or even know about Al-Qaeda all that much. It's always been a European and American problem with the Twin Towers and the Madrid bombings and the London bombings. So all that I knew about Al-Qaeda really was what I saw on TV, you know, when I was a youngster. But then having worked in the UK a little bit, there was an an article on, you know, it was on TV and on the radio about a man called Edwin Dyer who was beheaded in 2009 by Al-Qaeda in Mali. And I knew that the Americans, the French, the Israelis, and the British were the most hated by Al-Qaeda. And having this passport in my pocket literally was signing my death warrant. You know, little me, I was just a person born in Joburg, and I'd worked in the UK for a number of years, but Al-Qaeda wouldn't care either way. If for them, I was British. And when they found that British passport, all that they would make me do, they would literally make me kneel down in the sand. I could say I was South African. I could produce all the documents, whatever. And they would literally make me kneel there, hold up my British passport for the camera. And then they would shoot me in the head, or actually, you know, or slit my throat or something. And I realized that at this stage, I represented the sins of the entire British Empire. So things became incredibly real. And, you know, it's funny how I really marketed South Africa for my entire period in the desert. Obviously, yeah. I try to talk Zulu. I try to talk Afrikaans, but my Afrikaans is terrible. And a week before I was released, one of the senior guys of Al-Qaeda, a week before I was released, okay, so 5 years, 7 months and 4 weeks, you know, 3.5 weeks, one of the senior guys, Noah, walked up to me and said to me, so where are you from? Are you British or South African? And it made me so angry. I thought, well, that is why I've been sitting here for 5 years, 7 months and 3 weeks, because you guys still don't know what I am and who I am.
Yeah.
But yeah, things got serious, eh, with that British passport. I certainly was the most hated and the most favored to be killed out of us hostages.
How were the conditions at the camp? I mean, did you think that you're going to be released? I mean, you wanted to be home in time for your anniversary with Keith. And here you are, kept in this place. Speak to us about the conditions there at the camp, and what was your daily routine? How difficult was it?
So, yeah, Clement, I mean, okay, so this is something I actually go into quite a bit of detail in the book. But, I mean, what I can say is you can imagine literally locking your front door and going and sitting in your garden for 5 years, 8 months, and you haven't got a tap. Okay, there's no tap. So really, you need to start making things work. You'll have to drink out of the puddles. You'll have to drink out of the bird bath. You'll have to, you know, the food, maybe the guys will. So we had rice and we had spaghetti, and that was the basics of our food. But we would, you know, we would build our own shelters. As far as food goes, we would slaughter animals. I had no vegetables. Literally for one month, 2 months of the year, we would have vegetables. And that's if you classify an onion as a vegetable. You know, as far as vitamin C goes, we would drink those. Yeah, I mean, that was our vegetables, onions. And we used to get our vitamin C from drinking like sort of children's drinks, you know, that you wouldn't want to give your children at a birthday party because they will get all hyperactive and go crazy. They had those type of drinks in the desert, powdered drinks, and they had added vitamin C. And that was our vitamin C there in the desert. So it was one giant camping trip, a 5 year, 8 month camping trip. But what I can say is it wasn't so much the camping trip part, because I've always enjoyed the outdoors. You know, we had the farm in the Eastern Free State where I spent a lot of time being brought up, and I've always enjoyed the outdoors and always been passionate for the outdoors. So the physical hardships was something that I could adapt to and adjust to. You know, we are all far stronger than we realize. We have all bred ourselves weak. We adjust, we adapt, we have to adapt to our environment. Otherwise you don't cope. And the difficult part was the mental anguish. And that's also something which I think is some of the more interesting stuff there in the book, which I do go into in quite a bit of detail. You know, my mental anguish, my family's mental anguish, because it was one giant roller coaster, never thinking that you're going to go home, never thinking that this will come to a close. I obviously always tended towards the upside. You know, there was no one there to help me, no one to look after me. So I tended towards trying to see the best in things and to believe that I would go home. And what you find is that you don't know how you're ever going to go home, but it's not going to be today. But certainly, I believe in 10 years, I would be home.
And speaking about that mental impact, Stephen, I want to also talk about, I suppose, the impact on your spirituality as well, because what you ended up doing is convert to Islam. And I mean, it's not something that you really wanted to do. When I read the book, at the time when you converted, it's something you probably did, and correct me if I'm wrong, as a way of survival. But when you go on and telling the story in the book, you explain that, in fact, had you not converted to Islam, you don't know how you would have made it through the 6 years.
No, certainly. You know, I was a Christian. Obviously, beforehand, I wasn't a particularly good Christian, but I was certainly a Christian, and I believed in God, and I believe when you die, there is the day of judgment, as they call it, Kiyama, in Arabic, in Islam, Qiyama. And it was a big mental battle, but at the end of the day, it was survival for me. And I think we go into quite a bit of detail in the book as to this, because this is a topic I could talk to you about probably for about the full hour of this interview, you know, if not longer. But it was a very difficult decision, and that's not taking away from the fact that everybody has difficult decisions in the world. So honestly, I do see my time in the desert as me living in another country, as you guys were living in Joey's or Cape Town or Durbs or London or wherever. I was living there, and I try and equate my experiences back to the real world. So converting to Islam was a huge decision. It was a huge decision. It took me days, and I was hated. But it was the best decision I made, because it allowed me to start to live. And, you know, obviously 6 years in the desert is a very long time. And I go into it as in season, you know, there's seasons, just as we have summer, winter, autumn, etc. here, you know, in the real world, you have that there. But there were also the seasons of Al-Qaeda and what Al-Qaeda learned during the time, what I learned during the time. And my conversion to Islam, I believe, is what actually allowed me to experience my time there in the desert. So, you know, there's some crazy stories in the book, you know, slaughtering animals or digging a well or making grass, making rope from grass, really getting back to the basics. And I think my conversion to Islam is what allowed me to experience this and to actually grow as a person rather than just sitting in absolute fear.
Yeah. What I pick up in the book is that it was also that conversion to Islam that made you look at Al-Qaeda differently. You know, on one of the stories you tell in the book, and I'm going to quote here, you say, after I left the desert, I had many people from, you know, the Secret Service guys to punters around the braai making anti-Al-Qaeda jokes and, you know, inferring that they are a bunch of drug runners and people smugglers. From what I have seen, that's nonsense. These guys are passionate for religion and deeply fearful of God. When you converted to Islam, did that give you a different picture of these people who were keeping you captive, these people who were accused of atrocities around the world? Did you see them differently?
Clement, that's a really good question, hey? That's a very funny question, actually, because when I came out of the desert, everybody came out, and I mean, obviously everybody was very negative about Al-Qaeda. As you can imagine, my family went through 6 years of hell. I went through 6 years of hell. My mates went through 6 years of hell. Everybody was very anti-Al-Qaeda. But from my opinion, from my perspective, from what I have physically, you know, I'm the longest held Al-Qaeda captive in the world. So, and I really placed myself close to Al-Qaeda that I could stay alive. And because of that, I learned so much about Al-Qaeda. And, I could probably challenge 702. I could probably challenge every single radio station and every single interview I've heard with somebody who's got an opinion about Al-Qaeda, some person who's been tracking and monitoring them, some guys who have sent to infiltrate them. I believe 90% of the stuff that is spoken about Al-Qaeda is rubbish, absolute rubbish. They aren't drug smuggling. Certainly not what I saw. You may have some guys who are very weak in their religion and guys who you know, guys who have just joined because they want a free meal and want a bit of excitement. Well, these guys might be involved in something, but senior management Al-Qaeda, they are God-fearing and they operate by the book, and they won't smuggle drugs. I mean, they definitely smuggle guns. They told me once upon a time in the desert there that elephant poaching. Okay, elephant poaching, which is now a democratic thing, has been ruled out in the world, elephant poaching. They said, well, maybe they should start poaching elephants and selling ivory, because they don't operate by democratic law. And also because Allah will replace the elephant once it is, you know, once they've been shot out. But I certainly have a very different view on Al-Qaeda. I honestly believe, okay, besides the slitting of throats and the shooting and the blowing up of buildings and all of these things, which is terrifying, they operate by a strict set of rules. They have some of them, well, most of them have incredible character. If they're not going to kill you and you can engage in a conversation, you'll be quite in awe at their character. Yeah. So really, I challenge all radio stations and televisions, etc., around the world. Everybody comes out and says Al-Qaeda is this. I'm speaking for ACMI specifically, Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, the guys who held me. They certainly aren't the people that many people say they are, but they certainly are people who want to take over the world and implement Islamic Sharia.
What I realized, though, Stephen, in the book is that at some point you do question, you know, their understanding of, you know, their religious principles. I think at some point you ask, I think you mentioned, you know, one of the principles in the Quran, you know, around, you know, your brother, when someone converts to Islam, they are your brother. But how do you keep your brother captive? How do you treat your brother the way, you know, that some of you were treated when you were in the camp? Did you at some point also, while seeing them in a different light, also question their understanding of those principles?
Yeah, no, most certainly. I mean, I had an argument with Al-Qaeda in December 2016, where I received some information about my family, that my mom was, you know, very, very ill, critically ill. And this is detailed in the book. And again, it's a big story, but I certainly did, you know, at face value, Al-Qaeda, once I converted, Al-Qaeda would speak to me like I was human. But if I asked too many questions, or if I asked when I was going home, you could just see their eyes would glaze up and they would literally point to a tree and that would be it. I'd be banished. And it was difficult. It was a huge emotional battle. You know, like I say in this book, there are obviously many, many stories in the book, but there's also a lot about the emotional battle. And in 2016, I'd now been held for 5 years. And the emotional roller coaster that I was going through was absolutely awful. And it was here, I suppose, you know, Al-Qaeda, they did not all know the rules of Islam. Yeah. A lot of them were illiterate. It was only senior management who really understood Arabia Fusa, which is classic Arabic. The youngsters couldn't read or write. And there were times I would actually try and teach them, you know, how to write and things like that, which was bizarre. I mean, I'm South African. I can't write Arabic, but yet I ended up trying to teach these guys how to write things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People need to get the book because, like you say, what I'm explaining are some of the themes, but there's just so much where you go into details, right? About some of the stories that you had. You were kidnapped together with two fellow tourists, Jack and Johan. They make it easier, especially because your relationship with Johan deteriorated. So their presence there, did it make that captive, you know, palatable, or did they make it difficult, the fact that they were there with you?
Yeah, no, misery loves company, that's for certain. But misery doesn't love other miserable people particularly. So I was hoping that we would all stick together and try and see the best in things. But that wasn't the case. But because of this, you know, I really grew as a person, and I think I came out a far stronger and better person from my experience in the desert, because we did certainly have prisoner problems between the three of us. We didn't get along. We were three individuals. There are many, many stories to highlight that and to explain why they're in the book. But you know, it's difficult, Clement. I mean, 5 years, 8 months is a hell of a long time. You know, it's a hell of a long time. So I've been doing corporate talks. I've been doing a lot of corporate talks. You know, for some of the big banks and the big mining companies, and I've had wonderful feedback. And obviously, myself and my mates sit down at Bry's, and I get grilled all the time, or I meet somebody new, and then the story comes out, and then they grill me all the time. But you know, I was talking to some friends this morning, and they were saying that this book has helped them fill in the gaps to actually understand the stories. You know, it sort of added a bit of color to all of these stories. And in fact, some of my friends have even said that my one very good friend actually said that he felt a lot of guilt after reading my book because he relived the experiences there in the desert, and he actually felt as though he should have done more to help me. I mean, whatever he could have done more of, I have no idea. Nobody knew where I was. I was in the middle of nowhere. So it has been a crazy situation for my family, my friends, and myself. And trying to put this book together has been trying to document and put everything into a single place. But it's certainly things catch me off guard. Things catch my family off guard. I mean, my wife has been so brave to put her stories into this book.
Yeah.
She's absolutely amazing. My wife doesn't want to do corporate talks. She just wants to step back. And this last 5 months has required my wife to open up and relive the story. It's been amazing. I mean, it's reading the story has actually brought me to tears, and it's made me realize that there's still things that I need to work through, because reading a book is somebody else's story, but I was reading my own story, but I saw it as somebody else's story.
Look, so. And her accounts were very honest. I have to say, Stephen, at some point I shed a tear as well. How did you feel about that, though, when you see about and you see the rawness of how she felt when you were away? Because one of the things that she details in the book is that, you know, as time went on, you know, she met someone else, you know, and it was difficult for her to continue with the hope that you were coming home. She knew that it may not happen. And I know that when you came back, the first thing that she did when you guys got into the bedroom, you were about to sleep, and it was mentioned that to you. When you read that story, how did you feel? Did you feel somehow?
Yeah. Clement, you know what? Who am I to judge anybody, to be honest with you? My family and I have been thrown into the most insane situation. Where there's just no information. And that was the biggest difficulty. No information. Am I alive? Am I dead? My wife and I wanted kids. My wife must move on. There was just so many situations that were just so out of control. I don't know. What am I? One in 50 million? One in 100 million? What did my family go through? It is so outlandish. And, you know, it's funny. I refer to those 6 years as a big black hole. I came home and I had this big black hole, which I was trying to open up and try and make sense of. And there's still things I'm trying to make sense of. And I cannot judge anybody for anything that they did while I was away. And I hope people don't judge me for what I did while I was away, because it was survival. And you know, we all get one life. We all get confused. We all flip and have difficulties. We all celebrate. We all have problems. You know, there were times of this. I had no communication with my family for my 5 years, 8 months. Nothing. Not one conversation. And that was so incredibly difficult, because I had so many things I wanted to tell my family, you know, like, Kath, move on if you must. Because we never know when I'm going home. To my parents, please retire. Don't spend your savings on getting me out the desert. You spent your whole life working. Retire. Go and put your feet up. What I'm in is an indefinite prison sentence.
Yeah.
I was burning so many people. So really, it was survival of the fittest. But what I can say is that, you know, there's good things happen after difficult times. And my family have been blessed. We have been so blessed. I've got an amazing family, and I've got amazing friends. And one of the biggest things is that it has unlocked my old life where I got caught up in the small details in life. And now it allows me to see that life is far bigger, and we shouldn't be so judgmental with people. We should support people. We should try and see the best in everything. And we shouldn't take things so seriously, because so many things we take seriously probably never happen, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fear that something might happen, but it doesn't.
Yeah. I want to bring in Tudor Davis now, who is the author of the book, because the story was told to Tudor. Thank you so much for your time, Tudor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Clement.
How was it writing the story? Because it was told to you, and I imagined for Stephen, obviously, you know, it was probably very difficult to go back and rejig your memory, re-traumatize yourself trying to remember some of the difficult moments while you were in captivity. How was the process for you as the person who was now compiling this into this beautifully told story?
It was difficult for me. I'm sure it was probably more traumatic for Steve, because I did warn him at the beginning that it'll feel a little bit like therapy, that we have to go to some dark places and to revisit some memories that he may not want to remember, but that I'm not qualified as a therapist, and that you know, he needs to forgive me in advance if we go to those places. But Steve was just incredible, you know. Other than the fact that we actually never met until last week, that we did the entire thing over Zoom, which is, Clemens, you must know how tiring it is to be on Zoom calls. You know, so you do a 2-3 hour session, and I would be absolutely finished, not just by the content, which is so hectic, but also just the fact that you're kind of constantly online. And then Steve, you know, would go off and do several talks that day. He's in high demand with kind of big brands, banks and insurance companies and various others who want him to do talks. And he would just keep going. So, I mean, he's got this incredible energy, physical energy for that kind of thing. But at the same time, just his resilience. I mean, obviously the desert taught him how tough he really is. But he's just able to kind of go through this stuff and talk about it and open up. He's just you know, the integrity and the honesty that he approaches the thing with is amazing. And the fact that he got so close to Al-Qaeda on an individual and organizational level.
Yeah, yeah. Look, Tudor, I want to say big ups. I think this book is beautifully written. It's beautifully narrated. And it's easy to read as well. It's just a beautiful account. So well done to you and Stephen and those who, I mean, Keith as well, Magoo, the people that contributed to this. Stephen, I've got just a couple of questions before I let you go. When you came back home, you realized that your mother had died, and you detail in the book how that really, really hurt you. What did you find most surprising about the world today? You know, after 6 years of being kept captive in the desert, many things have changed.
Yeah, Clement. So what, you know, what I was struck by profoundly right on day one, was just how inclusive South Africa was. I found that amazing because I came out of the desert and, you know, I was held in Mill Park for a few days. I had a bit of an illness and we had two nurses there, and I sat there with my big beard and my long hair. And after 4 days there, the one nurse turned to me and said to me, so why are you here? What are you doing here? We've got all these doctors running in and out and all these tests and what have you. So I said, yeah, you know, a few days ago, there was that guy from Mali. He was released from Al-Qaeda. And they were like, yeah, we heard about that. We haven't got TV. We only heard about it on the radio. I said, yeah, well, that's I'm me. That guy. And I mean, they both gave me a hug and cried on my shoulder. Aww. And they said, God is good. Look at this. And it blew me away that it didn't matter what color you were, what religion you were, who you were, what you were. Everybody, I mean, it brought people out of the woodwork from when I was a teenager. Everybody popped up and was like, Steve, wow, good to have you back. Yeah. And that was incredible. I mean, it was, you know, and obviously I was quite emotional at the time. So all of these things really dug deep. It was amazing. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to see South Africa just being so inclusive when I came back.
Yeah.
And other things it took me a long time to actually realize what I'd been through. So it's quite difficult to make a statement to say things had changed. I mean, the streets were still where they were. The buildings were still where they
Trump
were.
Trump was the president of the U.S. There was Brexit.
Yeah. Things like that, obviously. Yeah. But I heard a bit about that in the desert.
Oh, yeah, because there was a time when you had access to the radio. Yes, I remember there was times when you were even listening to some of the news. You knew about pay back the money. Pay back the money at some point.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, dancing in court. But
one of the funny things was... Yeah, sorry, continue.
Sorry, I was going to say one of the big ones was Airbnb. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had no idea what that was. And that would silence Brian. You go to Brian, what's Airbnb? And everybody would step back like
what?
Who invited this idiot?
Yeah. Exactly. So have you met Jack and Johan? Because these are the people that you were kept, you know, captive with. I mean, Jack was released much earlier than you. Johan as well, a few months before you were released. Have you guys been in touch again?
So myself and Tilly and Shark, we've been in contact. They were keen to come out to head up to Namibia for a holiday, but then obviously COVID settled that down. So we've been having a few chats. Johan and I, I've been in contact with his family, you know, his sister and things like that, but I actually haven't spoken to Johan.
Okay. And just lastly, when you were released, you took the contacts of one of the Al-Qaeda guys. In fact, he gave you his number. Did you get in touch with him?
The record.
It's in the book.
That is so off the record.
Because when I saw it in the book, I was like, oh, I wonder if Stephen has called this guy.
Yeah. I send him smiley faces all the time. No, I'm joking. I haven't been in contact with the guy.
All right.
Yeah.
Stephen, well done on the book. Thank you for coming through and telling us and giving us your account of how it was, you know, being kept by Al-Qaeda for 6 years. It's really a beautiful account of your experiences there in the desert. Thank you so much.
Clement, absolute pleasure. Thanks for having us
All
today.
All right, have a great day. Stephen McGowan, the guy who was held by Al-Qaeda for 6 years.